to the Modern Federalist. Your compass in the world of politics, policy, and people. We're here to challenge norms, question narratives, and offer balanced insight on pressing issues. Your host, Charlton Allen, is a seasoned analyst and a staunch advocate for freedom. With his sharp intellect, he'll guide you through the maze of contemporary politics. Whether you're a political enthusiast or just a curious observer, you've found your haven. This is the Modern Federalist. Welcome to the revolution. The revolution.
Welcome to the Modern Federalist Podcast, where we scan the political landscape with a discerning lens. I'm your host, Charlton Allen, and today's episode is entitled The Many Loves of Fannie Willis. Our first stat centers around an investigator allegedly hitting on a witness during the Fulton County YSL RICO trial. Yes, you heard that right. Romance in or out of the courtroom. District Attorney Willis, it seems, thrives on the spotlight. She loves the thrill of high-stakes RICO cases, revels in the drama of election battles, and keeps a stash of cash handy just in case. But friends, there's more. She even had a soft spot for the attorney she appointed to handle the election cases involving none other than President Trump. Is it love? Is it ambition? Or just a penchant for chaos? You decide. In segment two, Sherrisse Trump is backed by popular demand. If you recall, we previously chatted with her in episode 7, where we dissected the state of free speech at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Now she's back, wielding her rhetorical brush to paint a vivid picture of her organization's nationwide efforts. Sherrisse doesn't tiptoe around the topic of bias reporting systems. She likens these systems to the infamous East German secret police, the Stasi, from the Cold War era. Imagine a world where every whispered dissent is logged, every raised eyebrow noted, and every unpopular opinion cataloged. It's a chilling thought, isn't it? Sherrisse's mission? To dismantle these modern-day Stasi networks on college campuses. And yes, that includes my alma mater, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. UNC's bias reporting system hides behind a password-guarded system, a digital fortification. It's like a secret door in a dimly lit corridor. But in the spirit of Ronald Reagan, UNC, tear down this wall. Let the sunlight of transparency flood these virtual halls. After all, a public university should conduct its affairs in the open, not in the shadows. Next, we'll pivot to a different legal arena. Zach Smith and Cully Stimson, the dynamic duo from the Heritage Foundation, beset the enigmatic United States Attorney for the District of Columbia. Buckle up, patriots, because we're about to unravel the threads of justice and power in the heart of our nation's capital. Hold on to your hats for the next segment, folks. We will travel to Vanderbilt University, where a pro-Palestinian protest went off the rails. Forget peace signs and kumbaya. This is more like a mosh pit of ugliness. We'll explore the chaos in the aftermath. Spoiler alert, it wasn't pretty. In our final segment, we gaze skyward. New York State, ever the legal battleground, found itself embroiled in a cosmic conundrum. A solar eclipse, a celestial ballet of light and shadow, sparked litigation. Plus, in this episode, there's good music and the reference, if you know, you know. Also, brace yourselves for a parody that's traveled metaphorical light years to grace our airwaves. In sum, this episode, it's out of this world. As we set sail on this intergalactic voyage, let us chart the constellations of liberty, navigate the black holes of bureaucracy, and seek out new frontiers of truth. The undiscovered country awaits. Our ship, the Modern Federalist Podcast, is fueled by curiosity, reason, and the warp drive of free expression. Engage.
Let freedom ring. Amplify your beliefs with the electrifying Modern Federalist Podcast.
Welcome back to the Modern Federalist Podcast. I'm Charlton Allen, and today I'm taking a hard look at a series of troubling allegations against Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis's office, as reported by Newsweek. First, let's address the elephant in the room. An investigator from Willis's office is accused of hitting on a witness during the high-profile Young Thug YSL RICO trial. Text messages revealed in court show the investigator, identified as Hamilton, sending inappropriate messages to a witness identified as Bennett. One such message read, quote, "Hit me up if you're bored later. We're not going to talk shop," end quote. When questioned, Bennett confirmed that Hamilton was indeed asking her out on a date during the ongoing trial. But this isn't an isolated incident. Willis herself faces accusations of illegally recording a conversation with a Maryland defense attorney, which is a potential felony under Maryland law, given its two-party consent requirement for recordings. This raises serious questions about the respect for legal boundaries and the rights of those involved in legal proceedings. Furthermore, the relationship between Willis and lead prosecutor Nathan Wade in the ongoing election cases involving President Trump and related co-defendants in Fulton County has come under considerable scrutiny. Allegations suggest that their romantic involvement led to financial benefits and a conflict of interest that undermines the impartiality required of their respective positions. Now let's talk about the legacy media's coverage, or rather the lack thereof. While Newsweek has brought the allegation regarding the YSL RICO trial to light, the broader media landscape has remained relatively quiet. This silence is concerning as it suggests a reluctance to report on potential misconduct within an office that should exemplify the highest standards of legal integrity. In addition to these allegations, we must not overlook the longstanding issue of overcrowding and unsafe conditions at the Fulton County Jail. Detainees have faced inhumane conditions, and the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, has reported that despite recommendations, the situation remains dire, with 13 individuals dying in custody. The United States Justice Department has even launched an investigation into potential constitutional violations at the jail. Yet some out there seem willing to ignore these human rights abuses if it means Trump or his allies could be imprisoned at the Fulton County Jail. This selective concern is not only hypocritical, but it's also dangerous. It suggests a willingness to overlook civil rights violations for political gain. We must demand transparency and accountability from our public officials and the media, the integrity of our legal system, and the rights of all individuals, regardless of political affiliation, must be upheld. Let's strip away the party labels and focus on a bedrock of our system of governance, the integrity of the system of justice. Whether you bleed red, blue, or none of the above, this concern transcends political lines. It's the heartbeat of our nation, echoing through courtrooms, chambers, and the very fabric of our society. Responsibility rests on the shoulders of those who wield power, the Fulton County District Attorney's Office included. When they falter, it's not a mere stumble. It's a tremor felt by every citizen. Our voices matter, and they should echo in the halls of justice. So we must demand transparency, accountability, and a system that's built on fairness for all. Because when Lady Justice wavers, we all sway. Remember, my fellow Americans, we're not here to play partisan games, particularly with our system of justice. We're here to safeguard the very essence of our republic.
The revolution continues in 3, 2, 1. This is the Modern Federalist.
Next on the program today, we have an interview with Sharice Trump, a fervent advocate for free speech and student rights who serves as the executive director of Speech First. She fearlessly defends the First Amendment rights of university students across the United States. Astute listeners may recall her appearance in Episode 7 of our podcast, where we discussed her organization's mission and its efforts at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. In that episode, we explored how Speech First was pushing the university to uphold state law and university policy, ensuring accountability for those who disrupted a pro-Israel speaker's event. But Sharice's impact extends far beyond the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. In this upcoming segment, we discuss Speech First's tireless efforts at other college campuses nationwide. Recently, the United States Supreme Court left a crucial issue undecided in a case involving Speech First. This development underscores the need to vigilantly protect students' rights from any encroachment on free expression. As Sharice eloquently describes, these rights are essential shields against what she aptly terms police state tactics. Beyond her legal battles, Sharice hosts Speech First podcast, Well Said, Through insightful interviews with experts, activists, professors, and students, she sheds light on critical issues related to free speech, higher education, and American culture. Her commitment to fostering vibrant spaces for open dialogue is unwavering. Charisse's background reflects her unwavering commitment to these principles. Before joining Speech First, she worked at the Heritage Foundation as the Associate Director of Coalition Relations, focusing on defense and foreign policy, as well as immigration reform. Her experiences have shaped her understanding of the delicate balance between individual liberties and institutional responsibilities. As a 2019 Rumsfeld Graduate Fellow and a 2018 George C. Marshall Fellow, Charisse explored the complexities of national security and foreign affairs. Charisse's articles have appeared in reputable publications such as Washington Examiner, Newsweek, and Town Hall. Her insights have reached audiences through numerous radio, podcasts, and TV shows where she eloquently articulates the challenges faced by students on college campuses. Let's welcome her to the podcast once again as we continue our exploration of the vital intersection between free speech and academia. Welcome, Charisse.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Could you tell us a little bit about your organization, what it stands for, and your role in it?
Absolutely. So I'm the executive director, and we're a nonprofit membership organization that represents, as you mentioned, students, our student members, in the court of law when their campuses violate their free speech rights. We also educate students on their legal rights and try to advocate on their behalf with regards to, you know, state policies and whatnot. And ultimately, when students come to us, we're talking about policies that specifically chill their speech through censorship and coercion, but also anything that they come to us with various policies or issues as well that are incidents that take place on campus for us to take part in.
And can you provide an overview of some of the cases Speech First has been involved in at other universities, such as the University of Houston, Oklahoma State University, Texas State, Central Florida, University of Illinois, University of Michigan, Virginia Tech, and University of Texas at Austin, amongst others?
Yes. Yeah. We've had a number of cases. You pretty much captured all of them there. But we've only been around for 5 years. And I'd like to say that we've got a lot of major wins, especially at the precedent setting level, which is ultimately what we're aiming for. So looking at circuit wins, as well as aiming for the Supreme Court. We have a case right now pending before the Supreme Court, whether or not they're going to hear it, against Virginia Tech University. And that is on a similar issue that we have sued a number of schools on, including some of those listed off. University of Central Florida, UT Austin, as well as currently Oklahoma State University and University of Illinois and University of Michigan. And that is what's called bias reporting systems or a bias response team. These are actually across the country on campuses. And last I checked, UNC had one, but it's behind a password wall. So actually, it's difficult to see how broken, what it actually entails. But I imagine it was put behind that password wall after we reported about it 2 years ago. So I mentioned that's probably why it is now behind that wall. But these are anonymous reporting systems that are managed by administrators on campus, oftentimes a team of administrators. Sometimes it includes DEI officers, deans of students, as well as some, in many cases, in our case in Virginia Tech, police, campus police officers. And what these do is they solicit anonymous reports from students on one another or on faculty for incidents of bias. And you ask yourself, who defines bias? Like, what is that? That's a very subjective term. It's incredibly vague. It could mean anything. And yes, that's exactly right. And that's how the university enforces those policies. They basically are casting a wide net for really anything to be reported, whether it be offensive speech. In some cases, like in Virginia Tech's case, they actually listed off many of the, they listed off what they considered bias, which is mean jokes, stereotyping, offensive language, offensive speech, not using someone's preferred pronoun and microaggressions. And mind you, these are all forms of constitutionally protected speech. This is really important to note here. So you as public institutions, you cannot regulate that type of speech. And it's, even if you are offended by someone's speech, you know, walk away, engage with them. But the idea that you can report someone to an administrator and then they can get called in, not face their accuser, and be told to go through some version of a re-education camp that they call sensitivity training, should be horrifying to all of us, because that's just crazy. And that's exactly what they are. And so that's a lot of what our lawsuits focus on. Also things like harassment policies. There's a number of universities across the country that have horrible harassment policies. Texas State University, we just appealed up to the Fifth Circuit on that one. And you mentioned Houston, we won against them last year on their harassment policy. And it's actually really common, and I can I can tell you, UNC Chapel Hill, some students have talked to us about theirs because they've made us aware of some of the harassment policy concerns that they have on that campus. Because when you look at the language that's used on these harassment policies, a lot of it targets constitutionally protected speech. And what most people don't realize is that it's not just the Title IX policies. So Title IX is a federal statute that all universities that take federal money have to follow, right? It's equal protection under the law or with regards to sex and education. That's what Title IX is. That's its own harassment policy category. But most universities have multiple harassment policies outside of that. They have like a discriminatory harassment policy and sometimes just one something called like anti-harassment policy. And they use that additional policy as an opportunity to define harassment as pretty much anything that they don't like or agree with. And again, you know, it's very similar to the bias response team. To be able to be reported and accused for constitutionally protected speech when it comes to harassment is actually very damning to someone's reputation on campus. And it's very terrifying for the students. And all these policies ultimately lead to students just not speaking up anymore. It chills their speech. That's the phrase that we use, the speech chilling. And they censor themselves. They just stop engaging in conversations. They stop speaking up in class. I've talked to a number of faculty members who stop having class discussion anymore after their lectures. They just lecture and leave because they don't want to get reported by the students who are creating an unsafe environment by asking them to debate an uncomfortable issue. And so it's getting to the point where campuses, everyone's walking on eggshells and no one's engaging with each other, which again defies the entire purpose of the university to begin with, which is to have this robust exchange of ideas.
Exactly. It also is mind-boggling for me that these bias response teams and the harassment policies are being used to harass people on account of their speech. And yet there's just a complete lack of due process. Lack of an ability to confront and ultimately in a courtroom cross-examine your accuser by allowing anonymous complaints that may have little, if any, substance to them. And then when there is substance, it's constitutionally protected speech. So it's going to have a chilling effect.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. It's very intimidating for students. And I think it's important to note like where these types of policies have been seen before historically around the world. This is very reminiscent of what the Stasi did in East Germany. This is very reminiscent of what we saw a number of communist regimes do, getting neighbors to report on each other secretly, turning your own citizens into spies. You know, it's very, very strange to put students in that mentality. But it's what ultimately gives everyone at the top the most power and the most control, especially if those at the top have a serious political agenda that they're trying to pursue through these policies. When you have vague and subjective language involved in how you're defining things like harassment or bias or offensive speech or hate speech, you know, that's when the person who's enforcing that, the people who are enforcing that are the ones who get to determine what that looks like. And they get to determine how to define things like hate or offensive or bias or harassment. And ultimately, they will discriminate based on how they want to enforce the policy. And this is exactly why, one of the main reasons why the Supreme Court has ruled time and time again, even as recently as 2019, unanimously, that there is no hate speech or offensive speech exception to the First Amendment for this exact reason, because who gets to define what those terms are? Who gets to set that standard? And, you know, will it change with every different person who comes in to, you know, how they think of hate speech versus how you think of hate speech? So, again, it's about, we don't want to put ourselves in a situation where you're discriminatorily enforcing these policies just based on your own political preferences, which is ultimately what's happening most of the time on campuses.
And what are some of the challenges your organization faces when advocating for free speech rights on college campuses?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's part of the challenge is just trying to get students properly knowledgeable on their own rights and to honestly take ownership of their rights. Universities are notorious for coddling students and putting them in, treating them as if they're their children and the university administrators are their parents. And so what that does is it keeps students in that mentality that they need to constantly go tattle on each other or go to the administrators every time they're like something is like even remotely uncomfortable or wrong, like stolen. Like we see these bias response teams, we've seen students reported or things they've posted on social media, even if it's just like an emoji, like a puke face emoji at someone's comment, or, you know, someone who laughed at a joke. And that person who laughed, you know, at an offensive joke got reported. So it's like the universities are trying to create a system, an environment where they want students' default position, default reaction to be to just report whatever they find even remotely uncomfortable. They want them to have that reporter mentality, like always trying to tattle and tell on each other. And that's really scary when you think about like how this is going to be like the future of the nation. These are supposed to be the future leaders of the country. They're going to be future software developers, and they're going to be future CEOs and pharmaceutical, pharmaceutical sales folks, and they're going to be like representing the government. It's concerning to think what this mentality is going to do to the future of the nation. But yeah, one of the biggest challenges ultimately is encouraging students to stand up for their rights, getting them knowledgeable on their rights and take ownership of them and understand that that's something that's important to them. Try to break through that apathy and that complacency that we so often see with students who are disengaged because they're kind of disinterested because they know whatever they say could be used against them in some way. And it's just keep in mind, I mean, the current generation on campus, their entire lives, the social media has existed. They've operated in a world where ultimately a surveillance state. If you think about it, like anything can be recorded, anything can be kept, everything you say can be thrown back at you even 10 years later or 30 years later. So they're very aware of anything that could be used against them to stop them from getting a job. You know, if they're reported for bias, even if nothing happens out of that report, they know that there's a track record of them. Like there's a record on campus of them being reported for something that someone found offensive. And that could easily be leaked or used against them in some way to stop them from getting a job. It could be sent to their employer. So they don't, again, this is very front of mind for them. So getting them to stand up and take control is difficult. It's certainly a challenge because they are operating in an environment that is very hostile and very difficult to be courageous in. So that's one thing. And also obviously educating them on their rights and educating them on constitutional principles, because there's no real foundation for them in most cases. You have a lot of good students, don't get me wrong, but not all students are like completely ignorant of the Constitution, but a good number are. Either they're ignorant of it or they're disinterested in it. So it's just a matter of motivating them to basically kind of take control of their American culture and be like, no, I have rights and I'm going to stand up for them, even if they went their whole life without ever reading the Constitution, which is actually a surprising number of students. So that's disconcerting, but something to work on.
Absolutely. It is so important, the work that y'all are doing, because of the conditioning and normalization that's occurring on college campuses of this type of behavior by basically a surveillance state, mm-hmm. encouraging people to tattle on their colleagues, their fellow students, and to be conditioned mentally not to exercise your rights. That would be tragic for the American system of constitutional governance, for that to be carried forward for generations to come. So it's so important that y'all continue this work for the future.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's an uphill battle, but because it's unfortunate that K-12 is not preparing them for these things, and then the colleges are taking advantage of them once they're on campus. So it's just a matter of getting the word out as much as possible on shows like yours and trying to get students more motivated to take control.
Well, thank you, Charisse, for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Warning, this segment is a satirical take. No endorsements, just pure entertainment.
Ah, Jordan Allen, my old friend. Do you know the imperial proverb which tells us revenge is a dish that is best served cold? It is very cold. In space.
Cool story, bro, but that's the whole movie franchise.
The force is strong with this one.
The Modern Federalist Podcast, hosted by Charlton Allen. Find us today where you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. I want to take a few minutes to talk about crime in our nation's capital that I think has some implications for the entire country. Specifically, I'm focusing on a recent commentary piece by Zach Smith and Charles Coley Stimson, senior legal fellows at the Heritage Foundation. Their article entitled "Crime is Way Up in D.C. Because U.S. Attorney Matthew Graves Won't Do His Job" presents a compelling argument about the state of crime in our nation's capital and the role of the U.S. attorney there, Matthew Graves. Smith and Stimson argue that Graves has failed in his role as the city's chief prosecutor. Despite the Justice Department's promise to surge additional law enforcement tools and resources to tackle violent crime and carjackings in the nation's capital, the crime rates there have skyrocketed. In 2023, Washington, D.C. saw a 35% increase in homicides, a 67% increase in robberies, an 82% increase in car thefts, and a 23% increase in thefts. Overall, violent crime was up 39%, and all crime was up 26% year over year. These statistics are alarming and point to a massive failure in the city's prosecution strategy. Graves has been quoted as saying, quote, "We have been surgically targeting and prosecuting those driving violence within our community," end quote. However, Smith and Stimson argue that this is far from the truth. They claim that Graves refuses to prosecute every case to the fullest extent of the law. One of the most concerning issues is the problem of carjacking. In 2023, there were 958 carjackings in D.C., 77% of which involved guns. Despite this, Graves refuses to prosecute most violent juveniles as adults. This leniency towards violent crime is not only endangering the citizens of Washington, D.C., but it is also failing to deter future crime. Despite having an office of 330 prosecutors, Graves' office has a declination rate of 67%. This means that two-thirds of the cases brought to his office are not prosecuted. This is a shocking statistic that raises serious questions about U.S. Attorney Graves' commitment to justice. Graves' failure to effectively prosecute crime in Washington, D.C. has led to a significant increase in crime rates. His approach to prosecution is not only ineffective, but also dangerous for the citizens of Washington. Therefore, I humbly submit that Matthew Graves should either resign from his position as U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, or the Biden administration should terminate him. The safety of our nation's capital depends on it.
Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and share the Modern Federalist Podcast.
Welcome back to the Modern Federalist Podcast. Today, we're spinning a yarn about Vanderbilt University's latest drama that's more tangled than a pair of wired earbuds in your pocket. In a scene that's as cringeworthy as a dad joke at a dinner party, a group of pro-Palestinian protesters decide to make their voices heard by barging into an administration building. They push past an African-American officer, spewing words that stung with racial undertones. Quote, "You are black in America, and you're not standing with the marginalized people of the world. What does that make you?" end quote, they challenged. It's a moment that's as uncomfortable as realizing you've been walking around with toilet paper stuck to your shoe. Now let's talk fashion faux pas. In a video, one protester stands out, not for his impassioned plea, but for his argyle socks paired with sneakers. It's a sartorial choice that screams, "I'm trying too hard," like wearing a tuxedo to casual Friday. And the face mask? Well, they're donning them like it's the height of the pandemic. Is it a health precaution, a political statement, or just a case of not wanting to be recognized when the chips are down? Masking up is so 2020, folks. It's time to face the music, unmasked and accountable. These students, who seem to have confused privilege with protest, are now facing the consequences of their actions. Vanderbilt University is standing firm like a bouncer at an exclusive club isn't having any of it. They've shown several students the door, and let's just say the exit wasn't graceful. So as we wrap up this segment, let's remember, activism requires more than just a loud voice and a cause. It demands respect, responsibility, and maybe a quick check in the mirror before leaving the house. Until next time, keep your argyle socks separate from the athletic shoes and your protests law-abiding, peaceful, and respectful. Here at the Modern Federalist, we don't mask our opinions. We are bold and free like the spirit of America.
The Modern Federalist, hosted by Charlton Allen, will return in a moment.
Welcome back to the Modern Federalist, where we pledge steadfast adherence to our Constitution. Sometimes we chuckle at the chaos which abounds around us and marvel at the cosmic absurdities that unfold in the legal universe. I'm your host, Charlton Allen, and today we're serving up a slice of legal lunacy that's sure to eclipse all reason. Picture this, friends. Hardened cosmic explorers, wearing orange jumpsuits and all, squinting at the sky, their eyes shielded by those funky eclipse glasses. You know the ones, they'll never be mistaken for Ray-Bans, those eclipse shades that turn even the most menacing felon into a celestial enthusiast. Sound out of this world? Well, it's not, as the state of New York was recently sued by inmates who wished to observe the solar eclipse, claiming it was a required religious accommodation that they were due. But let's dive deeper into this cosmic courtroom drama. Six inmates, ranging from a Baptist to an atheist, claimed their religious rights were being violated by a lockdown at their prison during the eclipse. Now, I can't help but wonder, did the atheist inmate sue for the right to not believe in the sun for a few minutes? Perhaps he wanted to catch up on his cosmic skepticism during the celestial show. But here's the kicker. The state ultimately yielded to the demands of the inmates, settling the case and granting permission for these individuals to witness the eclipse. Our cosmic inmates emerged victorious, contemplating the Earth's curvature, or perhaps arguing that our celestial home is flat, while donning their state-issued eyewear. Perhaps the state of New York deemed this a safer alternative to allowing them to roam the prison yard armed with DIY pinhole cameras crafted from contraband toothbrushes. And the taxpayers footed the bill for the celestial escapade. So there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. In today's America, at least in New York, even the moon must yield to legal proceedings. But let's not overlook the broader context. Does the state of New York's legal approach here, where they acquiesce to the prisoner's demands, align with the state's strategy in other high-profile cases? It's a curious consideration indeed. As the sun sets on another riveting episode of the Modern Federalist Podcast, I wish to extend my heartfelt gratitude to each of you. Charisse Trump, your insights have illuminated our airwaves like constellations in the night sky. To each of you who spent your valued time with us, whether during your morning commute or late night musings, we appreciate your intellectual curiosity. May our discussions continue to be informative, our debates engaging, and our laughter unabashed. Now I have a confession. I took a brief cosmic detour last week, savoring the wonders of the universe. But fear not, the next episode is already in the forge, hammer striking anvil, sparks flying. Brace yourselves, it's going to be a supernova thought. And yes, my metaphors dance this episode like Dwayne Hickman in a retro sitcom. To him, wherever he roams, and to Maynard G. Krebs and the rest of the gang, I tip my virtual hat. After all, as Ralph Waldo Emerson wisely penned, consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. So let's embrace the eclectic, the unexpected, and the cosmic chaos that swirls around us. As we navigate this strange new world, may each of you prosper, thrive, and discover new constellations of liberty. Until we meet again, fellow travelers, this is Charlton Allen, signing off for now.
Thanks for tuning in to The Modern Federalist. Don't forget to subscribe for more thought-provoking episodes. Until next time.